Okay, well, thank you very much, and thank you for the kind introduction. I think I'm going first here because I want to talk something about where we've come from. To understand where we are and where we should go, I think it's important to understand from whence we've come. And I first got interested in this topic of education and how it's changed over time several years ago when I was asked to do a study of a program at Duke University where I had done my undergraduate education. Duke had this program which was trying to revive liberal learning, the Gerst program and the Focus program. And I did a lot of interviewing on the Durham campus, and I figured though it was important that I have some historical background. So I started reading a lot of books about what university education was like in the 18th and early 19th century. And I must say I was rather surprised. Having been a university person for many years, one would assume that you would learn a lot about the history of higher educational institutions in the United States, but so much of what I did learn was new to me. So I assume if it's new, it was new to me, that it'll probably be new to a lot of you. Let's begin with the colonial colleges. There were nine colonial colleges. Let me see if I can remember: Harvard, Princeton, Yale, Dartmouth, Brown, King's College, which became Columbia, Rutgers, which was Queens College, and University of Pennsylvania, and William and Mary. All of those nine colonial colleges were run by or headed by a clergyman president. Most of them were founded by religious organizations. Congregationalists founded Harvard and Yale, the New Light Presbyterians, Princeton, and the Anglicans, several other of those nine. The curriculum was overwhelmingly focused on moral and religious education, and the purpose was understood by everyone from the clergyman president on down as the cultivation of Christian gentlemen. And a Christian gentleman was someone who was well educated in the high culture that Christianity and Greco-Roman civilization had produced. And all of the people who graduated from the colonial universities, it was understood, would carry the cultural and moral formation that they had received at their college into their particular area of occupation, into their careers. And the colonial universities or the colonial colleges, they really weren't universities as we understand today. The colonial colleges understood themselves basically as turning out the leadership class in politics, in law, in business, as well as in the clergy itself. Every one of the non-colonial colleges had chapel services every day. They began the day with prayer in the chapel. It was compulsory for all the students, and most of their tutors, many of whom would have been Christian clergy, would attend. And the majority of them, in fact, had both morning and evening chapel services that, once again, were required by all of the students. And this would persist in most of the schools that were formed in the early 19th century. In addition to all the colonial colleges, the many schools that were formed in the 19th century, many of them by Methodists and Lutherans and a few other Christian denominations, maintained that overall Christian understanding of what their educational mission was all about. And even a school at Mount Holyoke, let's take an example of the first women's college, which was founded in 1837 by Mary Lyon. It was not a denominational school. It wasn't Anglican or Presbyterian or Congregationalist. But it was certainly, Mary Lyon herself was certainly a very devout Christian. And as was typical until really the middle or really the later years of the 19th century, as was typical of the colleges of that time, students would attend chapel services every day. They would begin the day with prayer and prayer meetings. They would be expected to attend at other times during the week prayer meetings and Bible sessions. And each dorm in Mount Holyoke was outfitted with a large prayer closets where people, where the students were enabled to go and have a private a prayer session. And Mount Holyoke certainly was, I give it as an example, it wasn't considered among the more religious of the institutions, but all of the institutions, really, all of the institutions of higher learning in the United States, roughly up until the Civil War, and in many cases long after, had the level of religious and moral formation that you would find today only in perhaps a seminary or perhaps in a school like Hillsdale, and even I think they would be considerably, have an even higher level of emphasis on moral and spiritual formation. The books that they would read through really the middle of the 19th century were the classics. They would read Plato, Plato's Republic, Plato's Apology. They would read Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, read Xenophon. Most of the works had some kind of spiritual uplift, or there was an emphasis on the cultivation of higher moral and aesthetic sensibilities here. In addition, in literature, they would read Shakespeare, Dante, they would learn some of the Latin classics, they would read Virgil, Cicero, some of the other Stoics. And it was generally understood here that knowledge formed a unity, and there was no notion of a split between fact and value, or between natural knowledge and supernatural revelation. They were all part of what they would sometimes call the unity of knowledge. And it was very often understood to be a God-ordained universe in the natural order. Nature was God's creation, and the higher realm of the spirit was revealed by God in the Bible. And there were different methods of exploring those two different realms, the natural order of creation and the supernatural order of God's kingdom. In one case, one would utilize the methods of the emerging natural sciences to explore the natural world, to explore God's creation. God gave us the faculties of such exploration, and we were, in fact, obligated during this period of what I call the Protestant ascendancy to use those faculties to explore the natural world, just as we were obligated to read the Bible, God's revelation of his commands to us, and to reflect through prayer and meditation on what it said in the Bible. There was no split in terms of the understanding of knowledge. It was all part of sort of a God-ordained a whole. And there were different parts of the whole, and the different parts of the whole called for use of different faculties of our mind and our souls and our intellects, but there couldn't possibly be any kind of contradiction. And the Protestants, all of the colonial colleges were Protestant. The first Catholic college was, Georgetown was founded just after the American Revolution. But all of the colonial colleges and the vast majority of colleges that were formed in the early part of the 19th century had a Protestant Christian cultural thrust to them, and they tended to look upon themselves as Protestants, as representatives of the advanced science of their age. It was the Catholics who were looked upon as obscurantists. They were the ones who would put Galileo in house arrest. They were the ones who were supporting tyranny over the mind and tyranny in the order of the church through a monarchically structured a hierarchy in terms of church governance. At least the more congregationalist-oriented Protestants saw Catholicism in that vein, and they saw themselves as really the carriers of a very positive modernist spirit in regard to natural science. And particularly the Scottish Presbyterians, who influenced greatly where I've taught for a number of years at Princeton, saw themselves in the forefront of modern scientific explorations of nature, and again saw no contradiction between the desire to to unravel or to reveal God's secrets in the created order and the revelation of God in the Bible through the Hebrew prophets and, of course, through Jesus. Well, what changed? Change came about very rapidly after the Civil War, and there were many there were many educators in a number of universities, in Cornell, Michigan, Harvard, and several other places, who had an inferiority complex, particularly vis-a-vis the German universities. There was a sense that the Christian-oriented small liberal arts colleges, however valuable it was as a culture-forming and culture-transmitting a vehicle, was not up to the times in terms of turning out people who were in the forefront of some of the growing natural sciences, which were cultivated as they saw it to in a much more sophisticated way at the German universities. And most Americans who wanted to continue with their education in the 19th century after finishing a liberal arts college would often go to Germany to do their graduate work. And the German universities began to specialize and to have people who weren't broadly educated, people who were specialists in one particular field, whether it was in physics or chemistry or philology, was one of the particularly prestigious German sciences, studying ancient words and how they had changed over time. And as a result of some of the actions of a number of college presidents in the latter part of the 19th century, there was a proliferation of courses. Now, I should also explain, if you went to a colonial college or if you went to a college really until the Civil War, everybody would take the same curriculum. There was no electives. Everybody would start freshman year, take this course, sophomore year, this and so on. They started to proliferate courses and professors who specialized in one particular area. And in a fairly short period, some of the major universities became much closer to what we now understand what we now imagine as a university, with a proliferation of departments and fields and subfields and courses and more courses. And Harvard was the institution which first instituted the elective system and said that you can elect whatever, you know, courses what you want. You don't have to have a fixed curriculum. They really went to an extreme at an early point. They would later retreat, and there was a reaction against that. But there was a recognition on the part, however, of some college presidents, including the president of Princeton in the 1880s, James McCosh, that something was being lost by this large proliferation of courses, these specialists who were coming into the university who were certainly not Christian clergymen, and in many cases did not have any particular moral or religious formation, or were not, in many cases, even broadly educated gentlemen, as was the case in the earlier 18th and early 19th century colleges. And there was a lively debate between the president of Princeton, James McCosh, and the president of Harvard, whose name is escaping me now. You must excuse me for that. Yes, it was Charles Eliot. Okay, right, Charles Eliot, okay. And the president of Yale was also on McCosh's side. Noah Porter was the president of Yale at that time, who, like McCosh, thought that Harvard was getting away from its religious tradition. Originally, you have to recognize Harvard, which was formed by Puritan ministers. Its original motto was Christo et Ecclesia, for Christ and Church. Obviously, Harvard today isn't like that, and Harvard in the early 20th century wasn't like that very much either. But there was a reaction too in the latter, in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. Mortimer Adler is one person whose name is associated with this, and he was a student of a man named John Erskine at Columbia, who introduced the great books approach as a way of overcoming what was seen as this fragmentation of the curriculum and this lack of coherence to the sort of instruction that a student would receive, and a fear that there was a loss of this culture-forming and civilization transmitting a function of colleges and universities. It was a hope to restore this through an emphasis on the great books of the Western tradition, and John Erskine and Mortimer Adler were two of the pioneers in this movement. They later, they convinced Robert Maynard Hutchins, who was the young wunderkind at the University of Chicago, of this approach to education, and for a number of years, Chicago sort of became the center of great books learning. I think I'm probably running close out of time. Okay. Let me just read. There was a wonderful study that was done in the 1940s by the faculty, some faculty members at Harvard appointed by the president of Harvard at that time, James Bryan Conant, recognizing that while some great things were accomplished in the latter part of the 19th century with the expansion of the size of the university, the number of courses, the specialists who were at the leading edge of knowledge in their field, while unquestionably there was some good brought about by that, at the same time, there was some kind of loss. Yes, people said we are a more technologically oriented society. Yes, natural science has become much more important. Yes, we need to have more people in some of these emerging natural science fields to teach our university, but we've lost something. And there was a particular concern in the 1930s and 40s as fascism and communism began to arise in Europe and became very powerful forces. There was a sense that part of the reason why fascism and communism became so popular and so attractive to many people was because of a loss of the older religious and moral tradition. And fascism and communism was seen by many people in the 30s and 40s as essentially religious substitutes. Just as nature abhors a vacuum, so human nature abhors a moral and spiritual vacuum. And if you have a moral and spiritual vacuum, it's often filled with a vengeance and by fanatical movements like fascism and communism. And there was a sense of many people, including people like Adler, who accused the materialistic professors of being worse than Hitler because they had provided the loss of values that enabled people like Hitler to have such appeal to many people. Let me conclude here just with a statement from this Harvard report of 1945. It was called General Education in a Free Society. And they were reflecting on the fact that they had moved in the direction of the modern, what we today sometimes call multiversity, with so many departments and so many specialists, but with a lack of coherence to the overall curriculum. He says, a supreme need of American education is for a unifying purpose and idea. Now, they're saying this, remember, the 1940s. So those of you who think that this is a new development or post-60s development, it's not true. It's been going on at least since the 1890s. As recently as a century ago, no doubt existed about such a purpose. It was to train the Christian citizen. Nor is there doubt how this training was to be accomplished. The student's logical powers were to be formed by mathematics, his taste by the Greek and Latin classics, his speech by rhetoric, and his ideals by Christian ethics. College catalogs commonly began with a specific statement about the influence of such training on the mind and character. The reasons why this enviable certainty, both of goal and of means, has largely disappeared, why they have largely disappeared, has already been set forth in previous chapters. For some decades, this mere excitement of enlarging the curriculum and making place for new subjects, new methods, and masses of new students seemed quite pardonable to have absorbed the energies of schools and colleges. It is fashionable now to criticize the leading figures of that expansive time for failing to replace or even to see the need of replacing the unity which they destroyed. But such criticisms, if just in themselves, are hardly just historically. A great and necessary task of modernizing and broadening education waited to be done, and there is credit enough to its accomplishment. In recent times, however, the question of unity has become insistent. We are faced with a diversity of education which, if it has many virtues, nevertheless works against the good of society by helping to destroy the common ground of training and outlook on which any society depends. Thank you.